Hey, this is Jad Abumrad. Radiolab is a community of people, okay? It's a pretty tight-knit group. I mean, there's me, there's Robert, there's a handful of producers. There are the independent reporters and producers on the outside that help us do what we do. And there's you. Now, I haven't done one of these messages in a while, but I think it does bear repeating that you guys listening right now are fundamental to the whole Radiolab thing. And obviously, I'm not just talking about when you listen and when you feedback, which of course are amazing, but when you donate money, that is literally how we pay for things. It's how we pay our producers and our engineers. It's how we can follow a story like this series on police violence for like 2 years. That's just what it takes sometimes. And we pay for that predominantly through your donations because we are a not-for-profit. And frankly, I'm all about that. I think especially now, independent media that's not driven by a profit, that's willing to go deep, that is what we need. Okay, so we have a situation right now, sort of a continuing situation. We've got to pay for Radiolab. But right now, we have a really amazing opportunity. The Tau Foundation, the good folks at the Tau Foundation, have put up a challenge grant to challenge you to donate to Radiolab. And just a bit of background about them. I mean, they're really interesting. Their whole thing is to identify not-for-profits that they feel are doing good work, but with a little extra resources behind them could do so much more. And they have identified Radiolab as one of those places. So here's their challenge. If 700 Radiolab listeners step forward right now and agree to become monthly contributors at $7 a month, a lot of sevens here, then the Tau Foundation will donate $70,000 to Radiolab. Okay? Does that make sense? 700 people step forward, $7 a month. We get 70 grand to put forward into new shows and to do stuff that's more ambitious than we ever have. Now, the challenge ends April 24th. So if you want to jump in and help us do what we do, you got to do it by April 24th. And when you do it, if you become one of those $7 a month folks, you can go to our website, choose any Radiolab swag you want, a t-shirt, a hoodie, a mug, whatever. But please help us do this. Help us take their money. Go to radiolab.org, click that donate button, or you can text the word Radiolab to the number 69866. Again, text the word Radiolab, all one word, to the number 69866. A little form will pop up, and you can donate in a matter of seconds. Thank you so much. We super appreciate it. We cannot do it without you. Before we get going, just a quick warning. This podcast contains some descriptions of graphic violence and also some strong language. Be warned.
Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
Yeah. Look, it's hard to kill another human being anymore, right? Our fangs have retreated, our hands are weak, but as we've lost this ability to kill each other, we've gained an ability to read each other's tone of voice and facial expression. And often what's missing in these interactions is one side of that equation. Whether it's the police not seeing somebody because they're running through an alley with their gun drawn and it's dark, or shining a flashlight in someone's face where that person can't see the officer's expression. There's some mask, there's some breakdown in that equation that makes handicaps us from a normal human interaction.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab.
And today we are once again taking a deep dive into Tampa Bay Times reporter Ben Montgomery's mountain of data about police shootings in Florida.
So to refresh your memory, we've tried to account for every single police shooting from January 1st of 2009 to December 31st of 2014. And
just to remind you, Ben and his team at the Tampa Bay Times collected data from 828 police shootings, and there's all kinds of stories that you can tell about this data. Last week, we looked at police training and race and racism And obviously, there's so much more that can and should be said about all of that.
But this week, we're going to go in a very different direction. Maybe, Matt, you just want to set this up for us.
Yeah, so we want to tell this story because it actually plays out this this idea that Ben just mentioned, that there's this sort of communication breakdown that happens. And it does it in a very particular way. Because when one of these cases comes before a court, the court, more often than not, will only look at the moment that the cop involved in the shooting pulled their trigger. You don't consider any other moment. It's only the objective facts on the ground of the moment the officer applies force. So the thing that we found compelling about this story is that in this case, you can actually see, in kind of a rare instance, you can like you can step in and see all the little moments that lead up to that moment. And you realize how complicated these interactions get. So this particular story, it's a story about a white couple, Andrea and Rick Sheldon. And we're actually going to start the story with Rick. So on one of my trips to Florida, Ben and I drove to the northeast corner of the state up near Jacksonville to Rick's place. It's sort of like the wilds of Florida.
Hey, sir.
Hey, how you doing?
Matt Kielty.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Like sort of off the grid wild.
Oh, that's a big bird back there.
What all do you have on the property?
Pretty much a little bit of everything.
He collects rainwater in barrels. He's got
potatoes, tomatoes, squash.
These organic gardens.
Ducks, goats.
A lot of animals.
Turkeys.
Big turkeys.
It's fine. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Oh, couple dogs in the house.
Oh, you are so excited. All right, I'm gonna hit stop on this, replace the battery.
Eventually, we all sat down in Rick's living room. Rick sat cross-legged on the couch. Rick, I was just wondering if we could... I pulled up a chair across from him. If we could talk about your case. But even backing up before everything happened, can you just tell me about your wife?
I met Andy. She was down here visiting her mom. And we hit it off straight from the get-go.
Where'd you guys meet?
Trade Winds Lounge. Downtown St. Augustine.
Is that a bar downtown?
Yep.
What'd she look like?
Oh, knockout. 10. Dark hair.
How tall?
Oh, short little thing. 5'2".
You make the first move?
No, we kind of made the same move at the same time. You know, I can remember telling her, you know, we have a live burn tomorrow.
Rick was in training to be a firefighter.
At the academy, one of our last events. And then I'd call her whenever I got done. And we'd go have dinner. She's like, no, you're not going to call me. You're just going to come over. I'm like, I'm going to be stinky. She's like, no, because I know that if you go back to your place, you're going to pass out tired and I'll never see you again. So you're just going to come over here and take a shower. And I showed up, I ate dinner and passed out.
So that was date number one?
Yep, pretty much so.
Rick says they just, you know, sort of connected. And so they dated for about a year.
She moved down here and then...
two of them got married.
She went to nursing school.
Later became a hospice nurse. Rick eventually became a firefighter.
For Jackson Fire Rescue.
If we were to jump ahead to the night in question, could you just like back up to like the beginning of the day and just kind of walk me through?
Yeah. We woke up extra early.
What day is this?
April the 15th.
2012?
Yeah.
Okay. So you woke up.
Yeah. We were at our cabin in Georgia, getting it ready, getting it all set up and whatnot. And it was going to be our retirement place. Anyway, packed up, came home. Long drive, long hot drive. And we got home and, you know, started unpacking the car a little bit, started doing a little bit of this, that, and the other, doing a little bit of chatting, talking about dinner, having a couple of drinks, whatnot.
What happened after that?
I don't know. We just kind of started getting grumpy at each other and getting grumpy.
Now, we talked about this for a while. I'm just wondering if you can remember just kind of any detail of what you guys were talking about. And Rick didn't want to get into it.
I'd rather not make a statement about that right now.
Just about the conversations you guys were having?
I'd rather not make a statement about that right now.
Okay. All we can say, according to the police report, is that Rick and Andy got into this screaming match, and Rick says that he felt himself...
Shortness of breath, chest pain.
Starting to kind of unravel.
Loss of concentration, inability to think.
Rick says he's had problems with PTSD.
For quite a while.
It goes back to his former job as a paramedic.
I'm like, I can't take this. I need to walk away. Grabbed a bottle out of the refrigerator, and I got in my truck, and I was like, okay, I'm just going to go fishing.
Drove down this dirt road for about 5 miles.
I went to the big pond down there.
But right over by the pond...
I was stuck.
His truck gets stuck in the mud.
I was axle deep.
So he opens up this bottle of tequila. He starts drinking. He keeps drinking. Eventually he pops some pills.
Sleeping pills. Next thing I remember was, I remember having problems. I remember being upset. I remember having my, it's PTSD. It sucks. I remember calling my boss going, hey, I need some help. And asked for help, asked for employee assistance program help, the suicide hotline.
Oh, you thought you were suicidal in that moment?
No, I just thought I was losing it.
In what way? Is it just like, I'm just trying to...
Stop digging.
Yeah.
Stop digging. You don't want to look in his head.
It gets that bad?
Yeah.
Did he say anything to you?
I don't remember the conversation.
Okay. What happened after that?
Next thing I know, I've got the cops calling me going, where are you?
Hello, Richard.
This is a recording of that phone call.
This is Deputy Hollison with the Sheriff's Office. Hi, Bill. How are you doing? Hey, we're trying to come out here and help you.
It's about 11:15 at night, and the deputy tells Rick that he and a few other deputies are walking down this dirt road to Rick's place because they got in a call that Rick was possibly suicidal, that he'd gotten into a fight with his wife.
Where are you at? I have no idea, Bill.
Rick tells the deputy that he got in his truck, drove a ways away.
Until I got stuck, and I opened that little flask, and I've been enjoying myself.
Your wife's at the house?
Yeah.
Is she okay? Everything all right up there at the house?
Everything's okay at the house. Just
okay.
Domestic dispute.
And then Deputy asks, well, can I get her phone number? Because we'd like to make contact with her.
Because we want to make sure everybody's safe. Because, we got deputies out here and it's dark, and we don't want her to think that we're somebody prowling and stuff. So we want her to know that we're safe. So how's the best way we can make contact with her?
823.
Rick gives the deputy his home phone number.
You write this down?
All right.
Okay, so we're gonna try to make contact with her, and then I'm gonna stay on the phone with you. We're gonna try to get another deputy to call her so that we can get her to come outside.
Okay.
The two of them talk for about another minute.
You're not planning on harming yourself or anything, are you?
No, man.
Huh?
No. Nah, I just want to leave.
What was the last thing?
I just want to leave.
So at this point, the deputy is standing at the edge of Rick and Andy's driveway. Rick is still a few miles away over at his truck when suddenly in the background of the call, you just hear...
Shots fired.
Who the hell is firing shots?
That's Rick trying to figure out what happened.
Deputy? Crap. Deputy? Deputy?
Well, what happened there?
Well, okay, so what we know is while the deputy was talking to Rick, the other officers that were with the deputy had gone ahead and gone up to the house. Rick's wife, Andy, heard something, came out of the house with a shotgun. The deputies say that she pointed the shotgun at one of the deputies. They opened fire, and she was shot and killed there on the front porch.
Did they say...
Did they identify themselves?
Yeah,
or like, how did they surprise her?
So Ben and I were able to get all of the police dispatch recordings from that night. And if you go through these recordings, what you hear is this crazily drawn-out version of what Ben was talking about at the top of the story, the disconnect that happens between the deputies and the dispatchers and what they're thinking and hearing and seeing and what's actually happening. Okay, so if you rewind to about 40 minutes before that shooting, the first thing that happened was Rick called his boss. Now, we don't know exactly what was said in that phone call because it wasn't recorded, but what we do know is that Rick's boss left that conversation believing that Rick might be possibly suicidal, that there had been a fight at the house, that Rick had some guns with him in his truck because Rick and Andy had gone camping, and that there was a gun back at the house. But anyways, the first thing that happened after that call... is Rick's boss, who's a fire chief, calls fire dispatch, who calls a sheriff dispatcher, who ropes in another...
The St. John's County Sheriff's Office, can I help you?
Sheriff dispatcher. And what happens is all three dispatchers get on the line.
And who's out in the woods?
Try and figure out what's going on.
His wife is.
No, the guy is in the woods.
Eventually the sheriff dispatcher, this is dispatcher number three, he's just like...
Okay, let me just call the chief and get some information.
I'll call the fire chief back, try and figure this out.
I'll take this job, thanks.
Now, right around the time that dispatcher number three is making that call, somehow another sheriff's dispatcher, a fourth dispatcher,
Charlie, welfare check,
decides to put out a call for a welfare check.
10-4.
Basically asks a couple deputies to go to Rick's house, make sure everything's okay.
10-4.
Advised that he is in the woods and has a handgun.
Which is true, Rick says he had one in the back of the truck, but he says it wasn't loaded.
10-4.
But then things start to get more complicated because when dispatcher number three gets a hold of Rick's boss, the fire chief...
That's correct.
Can you just start giving me some details? He called him. What's his issue? What's the deal?
The fire chief says when Rick called him...
He said, Chief, I'm out here hiding in the woods. My wife's chasing me with a gun. Just couldn't take it anymore. And then he hung up on me.
Now, Rick denies having said anything like that to his boss. And his boss, as you'll hear, does seem to walk some of it back. But...
All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Things are kind of already set in motion, because then...
Supposedly...
Dispatcher number four relays the chief's story to the deputies en route.
The wife has a Signal Zero handgun and is chasing the male who took medication. I don't know if he's hallucinating or what's going on.
But then that same dispatcher, dispatcher four, calls Rick's boss, the fire chief.
Okay, now his wife is chasing him?
And he's like, well, chasing?
The information that he told me, his wife had a gun.
Which Rick says he said, but just that there was a gun in the house. That's it.
Uh-huh.
And he was hiding from her in the woods.
Okay, is she threatened to kill him?
He didn't say anything like that.
Clarification. Male half is hiding from his wife, who signals zero with a handgun in fear of her for trying to get more 1043-48.
10-4, thank you.
And this is what Ben's talking about these sort of clouds of miscommunication.
Because by the time the police show up at this house for what is normally a welfare check...
South Radio Weems.
Now she has a shotgun inside the house.
Chantel, it's Mike.
Hey, what you got?
She's chased him off into the woods.
What's that address?
He's also armed, maybe even hallucinating, so the deputies...
It's
so damn dark out here, we're blacked out walking.
Pull up in a blackout.
Just be careful.
Meaning they turn off their police lights, they get out of their cars, they don't even turn on their flashlights, and they start walking down this road to Rick's place. And one of the deputies even puts on these
night vision goggles because they think this woman has chased her husband into the woods.
Supposedly, he's in the woods by his house, so just listen out, too.
And as the deputies start walking down this dirt road towards Rick's place...
Somebody got pepper spray?
The situation gets more tense.
What just happened?
Get it out. Dog's coming.
Because, like, the neighbor's dog is starting to freak out. But eventually...
Okay, we're here.
These six deputies get to the edge of Rick's driveway.
Chantel, I'll call you back.
Okay, thank you. Bye. Be careful.
And it's actually right around here, about 40 minutes after Rick made that first call to his boss, that Rick gets that call from the deputy.
This is Deputy Hollison with the Sheriff's Office.
Hi, Bill. How you doing?
Hey, so, you know, the two of them talk for a while. The deputy's trying to figure out where Rick is, and eventually he asks...
So, your wife's not a... Your wife's got a gun?
No, I took all the guns with me, except for she's got 12 gauge.
Okay. Is she okay? Everything all right up there at the house?
And Rick's like, yeah?
Everything's okay at the house.
We're fine.
Just okay.
Domestic dispute.
No reason to be worried.
But as that deputy is talking to Rick,
I'm gonna stay on the phone with you.
Four of the deputies start walking up Rick's driveway. They want to check on Andy, so they get up to the house. Two of them walk up onto the porch. One of them even looks through the bedroom window where Andy is.
And she has no reason to believe the police are anywhere on her property.
She was asleep.
And presumably she heard a noise.
Grabbed the shotgun in the house.
And came outside.
Now, in this moment, all we really have to go on is what the cops said they saw, which is Andy came out through the front door wearing nothing but her underwear, holding the shotgun. The cops say they identified themselves. They were screaming at her to drop the gun. They say that Andy took a step forward, leveled the shotgun against her shoulder, and then they opened fire. They fired 24 shots. They hit Andy at least 8 times. She fell to the porch. Some of the police officers rushed to her, began performing first aid. Eventually, they radioed for an ambulance and paramedics showed up and pronounced Andy dead at the scene. At this point, do you have any idea what's happening?
No, not a clue. I realized that I needed to snap out, wake up, get my ass in gear, and find out what's going on.
but Rick's truck was stuck, and so it took a few hours, but eventually the cops figured out where he was, sent a crew over to meet him.
Yeah, the ground crew came over and picked me up, handcuffed me, and put me in the back of a four-wheel drive pickup truck and took me to headquarters.
They got him out of the car, brought him into headquarters.
Put me in a room, typical interrogation type room. And then I started noticing that they were being very, very friendly. Some people saying something about, you know, my camping equipment in the truck. I remember them authorizing me to have a cigarette in the room. And then we pretty much went through the same questioning that we've gone through so far. And at which time they informed me that they had come out to the house to check on Andy. And she had come to the door and there was an altercation and they shot and killed her.
That was the phrasing they used?
Pretty much, yeah.
An altercation.
Yes.
When you hear something like that, I mean, I can't even fathom how you respond to some news like that.
I still can't fathom responding to it.
Did you say anything to him?
Am I under arrest? Get these fucking cuffs off me.
How long did it take him to uncuff you?
I don't remember.
Were you saying anything to him while you were still cuffed?
From that moment on, I pretty much just what do you say whenever somebody looks at you and says, your wife is dead? We shot and killed her. Yeah. The absolute implosion of your mind just the searing pain, the explosive feeling, the do I get angry? Do I get sad? Do I break down and cry? Do I fall apart? Do I hold it together long enough to where I can figure out what the hell just happened? You know, what? You did what? You went out to my house in the middle of the night and you shot my wife. I mean, how do you respond to that? I mean, to this day, I'm still 6, 7, 20, 50 times a day asking myself, what are you talking about? What do you mean? She can't be dead. What are you talking about? No. No.
Did you see her at all after the shooting?
Yes. It's about 2 weeks afterwards.
Where was that?
At the funeral home. Went over to the funeral home and, sorry, my feet are going to sleep.
Yeah, no,
I reached down to kiss her and felt the edge of what I thought was a casket move. And it was that time that I realized that she was in a cardboard box that just had frill on it to make it look pretty.
Did you say anything to her?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Told her that we really needed to do something about her hair because it was a mess. And the rest of what I said to her is between me and her.
Sure.
All right, I need a break.
Yeah, no, of course. Take a break. Put the microphone down. Rick got up and went over to the kitchen and poured himself a pretty big glass of vodka. We kind of just walked around the property for a while. We kept talking. Eventually, Rick pulled out this computer bag that he keeps buried in his closet.
The diagram of all the shooters involved.
It's this bag full of, and the shots fired.
Mm-hmm.
All the police reports that were made about that night, medical examiner's autopsy report.
Yeah, you know how many times I've sat down and just written through all the questions I have. You know, the autopsy report that said that there was no previous surgeries. Really? She just had her gallbladder taken out.
These are just questions that...
Questions that constantly kept going on, you know. Coward says that he made eye contact with her.
That's Deputy Thomas Coward.
And she with him. Okay, so a guy is standing at the window. You've seen the elevation of the window compared to whenever a 6 foot tall person is standing at it. You're really telling me that you made eye contact?
Rick also has all the recordings of the police dispatch. How many times have you listened to those recordings?
Countless. Nonstop.
Was it like a daily thing?
Hourly.
He says he just can't stop asking himself, how did this happen? And then eventually,
Who's got the map?
Rick walked us outside.
Diagram's back inside.
Rick went back inside, came back out with this map that his lawyers had drawn up.
Take this map and position yourself in the positions where the shooters were at.
He started having me and Ben walk through the shooting of his wife, kind of like going and placing ourselves where each officer was.
This one down here, he's the one that testified that he couldn't see what he was shooting at. He just knew that the other guys were shooting.
So he's on the other side of the...
On the other side of that tank.
He walked us over close to the porch where one of the officers was, and you can see some of the bullet holes in the house.
Yeah. Here. There.
So that's it. So a bullet went through here, tore up the...
Yep.
Plastic.
Here.
Then we were off the front porch over in the front yard where three of the deputies were. So they see her come out and they start moving across like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Shooting a almost naked woman on our front porch in the middle of the night in the middle of the swamp. Fuck them.
Rick then walked inside and left us standing in his yard. About 4 months after Andrea Sheldon was shot and killed, the state attorney's office sent a letter to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement that had conducted an investigation in the shooting, saying that there'd be no charges brought against the officers, stating that what they did was a, quote, justifiable use of deadly force. Rick has filed a civil complaint on behalf of the estate of Andrea Sheldon. The complaint alleges each officer involved in the shooting violated her civil rights, used excessive force, didn't follow training, policy, and procedure, and intentionally inflicted emotional distress on Rick. When we reached out to the St. Johns County Sheriff's Office, they said they could not comment on the case pending litigation.
Big thanks to our producer, Matt Keelty, and Tampa Bay Times reporter, Ben Montgomery. Definitely keep an eye on our website, radiolab.org. As soon as the Tampa Bay Times big feature is up, we will link you there, and it's definitely worth checking out. Radiolab.org is the address. I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Desta Rusa calling from Long Island City in New York. Radiolab is produced by Jad Abumrad. Dylan Keefe is our Director of Sound Design, Soren Wheeler is Senior Editor, Jamie York is our Senior Producer. Our staff includes Simon Adler, Brenna Farrell, David Gebel, Matt Keelty, Robert Krulwich, Annie McEwen, Latif Nasser, Melissa O'Donnell, Ariane Wack, and Molly Webster, with help from Tracy Hunt, Valentina Bohanini, Nagar Fatali, Phoebe Wang, and Katie Ferguson. Our fact checker is Michelle Harris.
Hi, this is Albert in State College, Pennsylvania. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.